a multi-billion-dollar European energy deal.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Doug Krisner. There's a big energy merger in France this morning. After 18 months of negotiating, Franco-Belgian utility Suez and the French state-controlled gas company Gaz de France have a deal. It creates the world's third-largest utility, valued at around $107 billion. The energy deal has boosted the European stock markets this morning. Overnight in Tokyo, shares were down when the Japanese government reported an unexpected drop in corporate investment. But in Shanghai, stocks rose to a record. Of course, the U.S. markets have the day off. 125 years ago this month, American workers celebrated the first Labor Day. But it wasn't official. Jeremy Hobson has more.
This recording is from 1890. It's actually older than Labor Day as we know it, which started in 1894. At that time, the standard workday was 12 hours, says Cornell University labor studies professor Richard Hurd.
The move for the eight-hour day was something that was global in the 1880s and 1890s, trying to change the situation so workers could actually have leisure time as well.
In the summer of 1894, rail workers in Chicago went on strike. President Grover Cleveland responded with National Guard troops to break it up and arrest the leader.
The action by the president was extremely unpopular with the general public. It was an election year, so he chose this time to respond to the pressure to do something about having a Labor Day and selected the first Monday in September.
It didn't work politically. Cleveland's Democratic Party was crushed 2 months later in the biggest midterm defeat in U.S. history. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. By the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
In 1923, Sigmund Freud introduced his concept of ego. Today, ego has many meanings: one, self-esteem, or an inflated sense of self-worth. And in business, as in life, the role of ego has a huge impact. Let's bring in Steve Smith. He's co-author of a new book, Egonomics. Steve, the term ego seems to have many more negative connotations.
When we first started, Doug, the working title for the project for 2 years was Egoless. And the further we got into it, the more we realized that it wasn't just a negative thing. It was how we managed it too often that was a negative thing.
Well, how do we know when it's out of control?
Well, that's what we were interested to know, because you can have too much or not enough ego. There are four early warning signs that will let you know that you're off balance. And the first one is that you're being defensive. It's not about the best idea winning anymore. It's about you being the person with the idea. The second one is we get too competitive. And now we look at other people as competitors. They'll take disagreement with their ideas personally, or as a culture, we get hyper aware about what our competitor's doing, and then it causes unneeded anxiety around what we're not doing. The third warning sign is what we call showcasing your expertise or brilliance, which by definition shuts other people down because you're trying to dominate the conversation with it, and you lose diversity. And then the fourth one, Doug, is seeking acceptance.
So give me some examples, Steve, on how business has paid the price for ego gone out of control.
Well, we did a survey of about 1,200 people and asked them, what does ego cost your company? Over 50% said it's costing us between 6 and 10% of our annual revenue.
Give me some examples of business leaders you regard as being well-balanced on that fulcrum of humility.
One of the people that we point to in the book, and I think some will be surprised, is Steve Jobs, because he started as a person who was very egotistical. And after about 7 or 8 years of leading Apple, his ego got so out of his own control that the board of directors actually kicked him out as president of the company. So he goes through this process of working with Pixar and starting Next and so forth, and he said, over that period of time, I got kicked in the head. He said, I had to take some very rough medicine. And he said, but I guess the patient needed it. And he said, if I had not been kicked around for a few years and learned humility, I don't think we'd have today the iPod, iTunes, or Pixar would not be here today.
How dramatically can a company be turned around if at one point it was skewed a little more on the side of ego that tends to create a liability?
We have one example with Kimball International. They just weren't doing very well. And the level of humility that changed them was their willingness to let go of what they had always done well. They had always been good at paper production. And when Darwin Smith walked in and said, we're going to sell the mills, the board was like, you're crazy. You're insane. But he had the humility to say, look, we have to be open-minded enough that what has worked for us in the past is not going to work for us in the future.
Steve Smith is co-author of Egonomics. Steve, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Doug, thanks for having me. Appreciate the time.
Nepal is home to 8 of the world's 14 highest mountains, and mountaineering is an important business. But after a decade-long Maoist conflict, there's now a plan to bring those mountaineers back, Jill Barchet reports.
Here's an off-peak travel deal. Nepal is proposing to cut the cost of its climbing fees for Mount Everest by 50% in the autumn and 75% in the winter. The full permit isn't cheap, nearly $88,000 for a group of 10. Phil Powers heads up the American Alpine Club. He says no matter how big the discount, Everest is too dangerous in winter. The last time someone did it successfully was in 1993.
It's just obviously exceedingly cold. The storms are exceedingly vicious. And not only that, but generally you're in low pressure systems in the winter, which exacerbates the high altitude problem.
Power says the autumn is safer, but too short. And if a group is paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for a whole trip, including gear and guides, they want to maximize their climb time. Power says Nepal would have better luck luring off-season tourists if it put the discount sticker on easier Himalayan peaks. I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.